This episode of the Gospel Coalition podcast is sponsored by The Gospel Project, a chronological, Christ-centered Bible study that shows kids, students, and adults how all Scripture testifies to Jesus Christ. Learn more at gospelproject.com.
This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen.
Today's podcast is a talk by Albert Mohler called When to Stand Together, When to Stand Apart. It was recorded at our recent national conference in Indianapolis.
Looking forward to this time with you. The title of the session, When to Stand Together and When to Stand Apart, Principles for Cooperation Without Compromise. The interesting thing for us to consider is how central that question has been to evangelicalism from the very beginning. I mean, when you start talking about the modern evangelical movement, you're actually talking about the definitional issues of cooperating without compromise. And when you talk about an organization such as the Gospel Coalition, which is not a church, it's not a denomination, it's an association of Christians together and defined by the gospel, you're looking at one answer to this question in this contemporary moment. In our missiological context, a part of what it means to cooperate without compromise is exactly what you see here. But behind that is a huge story. I want us to look a bit at that story and then to consider the principles that might be derived from it. I actually want to give you a history in 8 movements in terms of how we arrive at this conversation in the year 2017 on the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. Now, to speak of this is to recognize that even in Scripture, there's a bit of tension, even in the Gospels. In Matthew chapter 12, Jesus says, "Whoever is not with me is against me." And in Mark chapter 9, verse 40, he says to the disciples, "Whoever is not against us is for us." Which is it? And the answer is both. Determining the contours and the context, we have to decide where we can stand together and where we must stand apart. If these issues were easy, we wouldn't be about this conversation. And if these issues were easy, we wouldn't have much of the history of Protestant Christianity over the course of the last century. How in the world do we arrive at this question with its context, its urgency, and of course its relevance? The first historical development I want us to think about is the rise of denominational identity and rivalry. Now, when did that happen? Well, in essence, it happened when Luther nailed those 95 theses to the castle church door there in Wittenberg. Now, that's a bit of a stretch, but only because the shape of Protestant Christianity became denominational. And, of course, that was a severe break with the inherited tradition in which you had one church that made a very clear claim to being a universal, thus Catholic church. And yet, by the time you get to the first generation of the Reformers, you have the establishment of churches that claim a spiritual unity rather than an institutional unity. Part of that was simply historical. For instance, the German Reformation was largely a princely reformation, as you know, state by state. And as was the faith of the prince, so was the faith of the state. You had very different patterns develop in the city church model of the Genevan Reformation and what took place largely in Switzerland. But even amongst the Genevan Reformers, you had differences between Zwingli and Calvin in terms of their ecclesiology, the order of their churches. And of course, there were theological distinctions as well. But there was a commonality that was understood amongst even that first generation of Reformers. But the heyday of denominational identity doesn't come in the 16th century, it comes in the 19th century. A footnote necessary here. The story I am telling is specifically the story of American evangelicalism struggling with this. If you were to shift to a different context, the story would be somewhat different, although many of the issues would be exactly the same. But when you think about the 19th century in the United States, you are looking at the golden era, if you want to call it that, of denominational identity and denominational rivalry. And that continued throughout about the first half of the 20th century. And so you're looking at the big brand names of American Protestantism here. You're looking at the Lutherans and the Presbyterians and the Methodists and the Congregationalists and the Episcopalians and the Disciples, and you're looking at the Baptists. And this rivalry was sometimes pretty significant. You have people like Fink and Stark who look at the fact that it's a marketing issue, at least in terms of the 19th century, that these rivalries were at least in part rivalries for members. And one of the interesting things to note is that the undeniable winner of that competition throughout the 19th century was Methodism. And a part of that was the fact that you had circuit riding preachers. The Methodists were out on the frontier before anyone else, and they were able to cover multiple churches at once, thus the circuit rider. Meanwhile, the Anglican tradition, particularly in what became known as the Episcopal Church, needs a great deal more. That's why you don't find Episcopalians on the frontier. You instead find Methodists there, and with the Methodists, Baptists, and others. And then you have patterns during the 19th century in terms of immigration to the United States, where you have the development of denominations that are at least largely ethnically based and linguistic. So you got the infusion of the Reformed from the Netherlands. We call them the Dutch Reform for good reason. And of course you have the Scandinavians who come with one representation being what's now called the Evangelical Free Church. You've got Baptists also coming from Scandinavia, what became the Baptist General Conference. And so even as you had these different denominational identities, in terms of a given community, it might not be so much rivalry or theological debate, but cooperation. Just an example of this in the middle of the 20th century, my parents grew up in a little town very much like Mayberry. And the Methodist and the Baptist and the Presbyterian churches were on successive blocks of the downtown. And they all went to each other's youth events. And during the 1950s, they scheduled the youth events so that they were not on the same night, so that you could go to the Presbyterian, the Methodist, and the Baptist youth events, which meant you weren't doing something you ought not to do. There was ecumenical cooperation to keep teenagers in view. But that was just a sign of the kind of cultural cooperation that had emerged. But there are still very significant theological differences, and denominational identity is really important. The issue to consider here is that the question of cooperation really didn't arise with much intensity because you were a part of a denomination. These denominations in America took on a rather full-service kind of programming. So you really didn't need to ask the question. The question's answer appeared to be obvious. If you were a Methodist, you cooperate with Methodists. If you're a Baptist, then you cooperate with Baptists, and you go right down the line. By the way, many people looking at this immediately assume that this denominationalism is a scandal of sorts that refutes the unity of the church. But even in the 19th and 20th centuries, it was rare that you had anathemization between the denominations. Instead, you had a very clear and sometimes pointed sense of denominational identity. Sidney Mead, the great American church historian, points out that denominationalism is the end of a formula, and the equation is easy to understand. Religious liberty plus conviction equals denomination. So the way you could avoid the perceived scandal of denominationalism was if you enforced a conformity. And that, again, could be found in certain European states, but not in the United States. With religious liberty as a premise, denominationalism was inevitable. And when we talk about full-service denominations, we really mean full-service denominations. By the time you get to the early decades of the 20th century, it's cradle to grave. You've got programs for children, and you've got annuity and retirement programs for the elderly. And you have your own camps, you have your own institutions, you have your own colleges. The question of cooperation came down to not so much whether you could cooperate with the Presbyterians if you were a Methodist, but whether you could marry one. And that was the closest ecumenism of the 19th century. All that changed in the early decades of the 20th century with the second great development, which was the fundamentalist-modernist controversy. Something changed in terms of the patterns of American Protestantism, and that something was the rise of theological liberalism and the crisis of this great controversy. All of the major Protestant denominations defined in terms of the mainstream, they were all affected in one way or another by the fundamentalist-modernist controversy. It had been brewing for some time. Of course, theological liberalism didn't emerge just in the early decades of the 20th century. But lay people and more conservative pastors became aware of encroaching theological liberalism within their seminaries. You had famous cases such as Charles Augustus Briggs at Union Theological Seminary. What you had more than anything else was a series of failed heresy trials. So the perception in the early decades of the 20th century was that orthodoxy, which was still creedally enshrined in these denominations, would be upheld. The belief was that the heretics were aberrations that could be dealt with by means of denominational policy. But by the time you get to the late 1920s and the early 1930s, it is clear that denominational lethargy. I often cite Bradley Longfield, who in his book on the Presbyterian controversy had the subtitle, Fundamentalists, Modernists, and Moderates. And those were the three parties. And it wasn't that the liberals won, it was that the moderates won. It was that those who were committed to the denomination avoiding theological controversy, they more than anyone else won, and that, of course, then enshrined theological liberalism. The point of the fundamentalist-modernist controversy is that by the end of that controversy, the conservatives left. The result of the fundamentalist-modernist controversy was that in mainline Protestantism, by and large, the evangelicals were either evicted or they brought about their own heartbroken exodus. And this is how you end up with an entire constellation of conservative churches, smaller denominations. So you go from the Northern Presbyterian Church to the development of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church under the leadership of someone like J. Gresham Machen, amongst others. You see the history of this played out in terms of the history of just one institution, Princeton Seminary, and the development then of Westminster Theological Seminary. By the time you get to the end of the dating of the fundamentalist-modernist controversy, what has become clear is that the conservatives have come to the conclusion that this is not a choice between a more and a less orthodox Christianity, but rather between Christianity and a new religion posing as Christianity. The classic statement of this, of course, is Gresham Machen's Christianity and Liberalism, where he articulated this in its quintessential form, coming to the conclusion that theological liberalism had so abandoned the faith at core doctrines, including not just the virgin birth of Christ, as if you could say just the virgin birth of Christ, although that was where many of these controversies began. But clearly it came down to the bodily resurrection of Christ, the Christological consensus of the early church, the doctrine of the Trinity. Theological liberalism was a subversion of supernaturalism. And of course, this applied to their understanding of Scripture as well. You have famous figures like not only Briggs, but in the pulpit, someone like Harry Emerson Fosdick. And the thing that made the modernists modernists in terms of theological liberalism, modernism was their chosen label, was that they were breathtakingly honest about their repudiation of Orthodox Christianity. By the time you get to, say, 1929, 1930, there's really no doubt about the gulf that had been created between Orthodox believers in these denominations and churches and the theological liberals. Machen put it this way, and again, this is from his work, Christianity and Liberalism. He said, "We're not dealing here with delicate personal questions. We're not presuming to say whether such and such an individual man is a Christian or not. God only can decide such questions. No man can say with assurance whether the attitude of certain individual liberals toward Christ is saving faith or not. But one thing is perfectly plain. Whether or not liberals are Christians, it is at any rate perfectly clear that liberalism is not Christianity. And that being the case, it is highly undesirable that liberalism and Christianity should continue to be propagated within the bounds of the same organization. A separation between the two parties in the church is the crying need of the hour." And of course, that separation took place. Where did that leave Machen and those who stood with him? Outside the larger historic denomination, having to recreate a conservative and orthodox semblance of the same. And the sad history was the loss of institutions. Because just remember, during the 19th century in particular, conservative Christians had poured millions and millions of dollars into building theological seminaries, colleges, universities, and entire denominational structures that they then had to abandon, and that at enormous sacrifice and enormous heartbreak. So you look at the fundamentalist-modernist controversy, and you recognize that by the time you come to the 1930s, you've got the conservatives leaving, with some interesting exceptions to which we will return. You also have captive congregations. So throughout much of the country, you had congregations of these denominations that were relatively untouched by the theological liberalism. The liberalism, after all, was especially acute in urban areas. And so many of these denominations had thousands, if not at least hundreds, of churches in more rural areas, especially throughout the Midwest, where theological liberalism had not encroached. And these congregations, by and large, did not see the problem, and they stayed. They later became captive congregations. We'll come back to them in just a moment. The third development came after the fundamentalist-modernist controversy, and this was, on the left, the rise of the ecumenical movement. Now, the thing to note is that the age of denominationalism had largely prevented this kind of ecumenical movement. The idea of ecumenism was that denominational identity was a scandal of sorts, and in order to overcome that, the churches should at least move towards a more visible institutional and confessional unity. Now, here's what you need to remember. This couldn't happen until the people who were left, and most importantly, left in control in those denominations, were the theological minimalists. So this was only possible because the conservatives had A, exited, or B, been robbed of influence. And so it makes sense that if your agenda is theological minimalism, then there's less distance between the Presbyterians and the Baptists and the Methodists and the Lutherans, and therefore the idea of some kind of pan-Protestantism can become thinkable. This becomes institutionalized in the second half of the 20th century in the National Council of Churches and the World Council of Churches. And it became organized in terms of, for instance, in the World Council of Churches, what was known as the Faith and Order Commission. And there you had representatives of the denominations, and they met together in order to be involved in theological dialogue with two goals. One of them was to increase the recognition of each other as churches. Now, that's not just a matter of politeness. That's not just being nice and saying, I'll call you a church if you'll call me a church. It was also a matter of the recognition of sacrament and ministry. And for instance, baptism and other issues similar. And so it's bigger than just etiquette. It was actually recognizing the legitimacy of other denominational sacraments and ministerial actions. And the second goal was to create a visible worldwide unity of the church, in which ultimately it was felt, especially by the most radical ecumenists, that these denominational separate identities would simply melt away. Now, that we should note, even amongst these more liberal denominations, has not happened. Their theology, we should note, has become virtually the same, but it turns out that you might argue sociologically that institutionalism wins. There's simply too much invested in these separate denominational structures, even in liberal Protestantism, for them actually to have melded into one another. But we leave them for a moment. By the way, just a couple of interesting things to note. You might say that the high water mark of this ecumenical movement came in 1999. With what was known as the Joint Declaration on Justification, which was not only from the major mainline Protestant denominations, but also with the Roman Catholic Church. And thus in 1999, it was claimed then that the scandal of the Reformation had at least been overcome on the doctrine of justification by this joint declaration between the World Lutheran bodies and the Roman Catholic Church. Now, you say, how could that be? How can sola fide just disappear as an issue of contention? It was because, in the words of the Catholic summary, they decided to privilege sola gratia over sola fide, the grace alone over faith alone. Now, there's also an embedded time bomb in that, which was that they would have to revisit this in particulars later. Now, that's the hard part. That's the 95 theses on the door. They're still nailed there. And so it's not as if they actually came to an absolute joint declaration of justification, but they'll work this out. Now, I said that's the high watermark, and that's because just about everything since then has been something of a retreat. Partly because even though Popes John Paul II and Benedict XVI were avid ecumenists, they were not happy about theological liberalism triumphing in the Protestant denominations. And more recently, the LGBT revolution, the larger sexual revolution, has driven a significant wedge between these more ecumenical Protestant denominations in the Vatican, as does the issue of women in the pastorate, the ordination of women. That remains a very contentious issue, even with the current Pope, who has openly declared his continuity with John Paul II's pastoral declaration on the ministry. So anyway, that's interesting. One more footnote. These are free. One more footnote. The Vatican right now has come very, very close to claiming the same kind of declaration, the same kind of ecumenical agreement with the Anglican Communion. And so in recent days, not just in recent months, in recent days, the first Anglican service in the Vatican ever was held, an evensong with the choirs and all the beauty of the Anglican tradition and all the rest. But the Anglican Communion on the sexuality issues now presents the Vatican with the problem it can't resolve with etiquette. And so at this point, they've agreed on the beauty of Anglican music. Whether it can go beyond that, we shall see. Bad timing for ecumenism in terms of the LGBT revolution. The fourth great development was that fundamentalism developed its own network. So liberal Protestantism moved into that liberal mode, and ecumenism was its manifestation. On the right, fundamentalism started its own network. And so by the time you get to, say, the Second World War, fundamentalism has developed its own Bible colleges and institutions. It's developed its own printing houses, its own periodicals. I grew up with relatives who got the Sword of the Lord. And that's where, as a Southern Baptist, I learned how liberal we were, according to the Sword of the Lord. And our women wore pants, and just all kinds of things. And it was this whole institutional network of fundamentalism became central to the definition of conservative Christianity in America. But it's not only a network of institutions. It also came down to a principle. A principle very germane to our consideration. What marked fundamentalism was not only a disengagement from the larger culture, but a principle that was called second-degree separationism. Second-degree separationism means that, to put it as plainly and charitably as I think I can, you not only do not have fellowship with liberals, you can't have fellowship with someone else who, though Orthodox, has fellowship with liberals. Now, that may sound very esoteric and abstract, but it's not when you think about ministry and church life, because it means that not only can you not be a part of a mixed church, as it was called, that is a church that would include more Orthodox and less Orthodox, but you could not be in any cooperation with a congregation or a minister or an institution that would be in such a denomination, though that minister or that congregation or that institution may be itself fully Orthodox. Now, you can understand defensively why second-degree separationism became important, because after all, these conservatives, by and large, had learned by very sad experience what it was like to be in a denomination where you eventually found yourself unable to protect theological orthodoxy and to defend the faith, where you saw institutions built, institutions taken away. Second-degree separationism was a way that, I have to say with full respect, was a well-intended, context-explainable decision and principle to say the only way we can protect our own theological integrity is not to hang around with people who hang around with people who have no theological integrity. And it's sort of like a principle of dating. You can, second-degree separation. Every parent understands this in terms of peer context and all the rest. This is not crazy. And thus, it would be slander to suggest that this is somehow just a matter of fundamentalist casuistry. Now, it did lead to fundamentalist casuistry. Once again, when I was in college, and I went to a Southern Baptist college, a very concerned fundamentalist relative sent me the Sword of the Lord. And I would read the Sword of the Lord, and it was bizarre. It was bizarre to me, made perfect sense to the subscribers of the Sword of the Lord. And I came to admire many of their preachers and went to hear them preach. I was extremely interested in all this. So I would go. I went to hear John R. Rice preach in Birmingham when he preached. And he thundered, but he preached the gospel. And I can remember, they used to have a Q&A. You know, it's just like a fundamentalist version of Dear Abby, only it was kind of like Dear Alfred. And they asked the question. Here was the question that got my attention when I was in college. Here was the question. And if you know all these particulars, I'm going to know how old you are. But the question was, is it permissible for me as a fundamentalist pastor to ride in a car with a Southern Baptist pastor going to a Bill Gothard conference? It's perfect if you understand it. And the answer came back, you must not ride with a Southern Baptist to a conference you must not attend. In other words, the whole thing was thrown out saying you shouldn't be going to the Bill Gothard conference because they're not, even though the speakers may be all fundamentalists, you're not sure all the people in the crowd are, and you shouldn't go with a Southern Baptist. Now, why Southern Baptist? It's because Southern Baptists had not yet experienced what became known as the conservative resurgence, a much more confessional identity. And there was no doubt that at the time there were theological liberals in the Southern Baptist Convention. But the question wasn't about hanging around with Southern Baptist liberals. It was a question about hanging around with Southern Baptist conservatives. Second degree separation was the answer. That's followed by the fifth great development, which is the emergence of the new evangelicalism. Why is the new evangelicalism different than fundamentalism? Primarily, it was a rejection, I'll quote Carl Henry here, of the disengagement of conservative Christianity from the larger culture, including the theological debates of the age. Secondly, it was a rejection of theological minimalism of a different sort than the liberals. As he said, the liberals have a theological minimalism, they only believe certain things. But he said the fundamentalists have developed their own theological minimalism, in which they focus on certain doctrines that are not of first-order importance. Dr. Henry said it's an eschatological preoccupation. Dr. Henry didn't disagree on the eschatological teaching, but instead said that should not be the main issue of our frontline theological warfare. That's out of balance. And so you have the rejection of disengagement, and you have the rejection of second-degree separationism and a rejection of a certain fundamentalist form of theological minimalism or preoccupation. The new evangelical emerged largely after World War II. The names are famous. Billy Graham. You can't talk about the new evangelicalism without Billy Graham. And in terms of our conversation here, you can't talk about cooperation without talking about a new kind of cooperation that came largely through the ministry of Billy Graham. Billy Graham's crusades, which so shaped evangelicalism and American culture, beginning especially in the late 1940s, throughout the 1950s and beyond, was premised upon a certain form of cooperation amongst evangelical churches. The interesting thing was that when Billy Graham went to New York in the late 1950s, he required a cooperation not only amongst the evangelical denominations, but amongst the mainline Protestant denominations. Dr. Graham's philosophy, it's well articulated in terms of his own writings, probably best defined in the secondary literature by Grant Wacker in his biography of Billy Graham. His philosophy was, it is most important that people come into the stadium to hear the gospel, or Madison Square Garden. Wherever he would be in a location. And thus, he wanted the cooperation of churches so that they did not block people from coming, but rather made it a major issue of communal concern. And Dr. Graham never got into distinctions between the denominations. He wasn't speaking about baptism or ecclesiology. The hallmark of his ministry was preaching the gospel and calling for sinners to believe and to repent. And so This led to a very sharp division between the new evangelicalism and fundamentalism. One issue was simply who was sitting on the platform in Dr. Graham's New York crusade. And the fact is, there were some liberal representatives of the mainline Protestant denominations who were on the platform. That was a bridge too far. Many of the fundamentalists assumed that Billy Graham, who after all come from their ranks, including Bob Jones University, at least in some time there, they believed that he would follow in the line of other fundamentalist preachers. This new form of cooperation became the breaking point. So by the time you get to the 1950s, the new evangelicalism is a very different movement than fundamentalism, though there may be many friendships, many family connections. Institutionally, it's very different. So there's the formation of an entire network of evangelical institutions, and that included periodicals, the formation of Christianity Today, with Carl Henry as its founding editor. I know in the masthead, the founding editor is Nelson Bell. More on that in just a moment. That's Billy Graham's father-in-law, but it was Carl Henry who actually edited the magazine. And one of the interesting things to note is that when Christianity Today, the magazine, was established, Carl Henry said it as the policy of the magazine, his vision of the magazine, that it would include representatives from those mainline churches. Now, that's because, remember those captive churches we talked about in the fundamentalist-modernist controversy? Harold John Ockenguy, Dr. Graham, Nelson Bell, who was one of the leaders in the effort to try to bring renewal in the Presbyterian denomination, Dr. Graham's father-in-law, who had been a famous missionary doctor in China, you have, and Carl Henry and others, you have the effort to try to bring about renewal, conservative recovery in these mainline Protestant denominations. Now you say, how can that fit more than a generation after the conservatives lost? It's because these evangelicals believed, I think quite rightly, they had the better theological argument. And that if they could come back with the better theological argument, and if they could demonstrate the power of the gospel, they just might be able to recover some of these churches or influence within these denominations. So those captive churches became very much a focus. So what's interesting is that in 1947, when Fuller Theological Seminary was established, you can read this in George Marsden's work on history, the history of Fuller, Reforming Fundamentalism. The original faculty, which included Carl Henry and as president, Harold John Ockenguy, they intended to continue in their own mainline denominations, largely Presbyterian and Baptist. Carl Henry later in his autobiography said he only found out he'd been kicked out of the Northern Baptist Convention, as it was at the time, because he got a letter saying that he had been expelled from their annuity program as an ordained minister. You had others on the faculty at Fuller who were not recognized. They had moved from the East, where they had been recognized by the mainline Protestant Mainline Presbyterian Church and local presbytery. They got to California, and they were denied the recognition and transfer of their ordination, which they had actually counted on. They did not expect this by the more liberal presbytery there in Southern California. So Fuller was established with the idea that it would be a catalyst for renewal, clearly evangelical in its own teachings, within mainline Protestantism, and the identity crisis, or shall you say, the unfolding identity of Fuller Seminary throughout the years has largely been an effort to maintain that, which is one of the reasons why now Fuller still continues to educate an incredible percentage of ministers in the Presbyterian Church USA. But it's also revised its theological statement. It did that in the 1970s to drop inerrancy and some other issues. There again is a parable of what we're looking at here. But in the new evangelicalism, as I said, Carl Henry intended with Christianity Today to reach out to larger champions of orthodoxy. So, for instance, in the original advisory board of editors, he included people like from the United Kingdom, F.F. Bruce. Bruce was clearly a conservative orthodox Christian. He did not affirm the inerrancy of Scripture, but Henry included him. More famously, perhaps, G.C. Birkhauer, who was included as an advisory editor, invited to be one for Christianity Today. That was still when there was this hope that the new evangelicalism could be a catalyst for recovering those mainline denominations that had been lost. But this required a new definition of cooperation. Instead, the definition was to be biblical orthodoxy. And it was the biblical orthodoxy of the congregation or of the individual or the institution, not of the larger denomination. So, in other words, the idea was we will partner and cooperate with anyone who's orthodox in any church, wherever they are found, regardless of the fact there may also be liberals in those churches, in order to be a catalyst for theological recovery. Well, this is the reason why there have been endless internal and external questions about evangelical identity. It's been an external preoccupation, right down to the fact the media never knows who is and is not an evangelical. Even in the 2016 presidential campaign, it came down to the fact they know who the Jewish population is, they know who Roman Catholics are, they don't know who anyone is who isn't a liberal Protestant, a member of one of the mainline churches, or Jewish or Catholic, so you are an evangelical. But the confusion outside has also been matched by a consternation inside. Evangelicalism has been debating its identity from within ever since the new evangelicalism emerged just after World War II. I have to move quickly. The sixth great development was the pressures of late modernity. So if you fast forward from the period right after World War II to the present, what's changed? Well, what's changed more than anything else is the culture around us. All the same institutional, theological, denominational, ecclesiological questions continue, but in a very different context. Now the context is in the pressure cooker of a rapidly secularizing age. Now the other thing to note is that the new evangelicalism followed mainline Protestantism in this presumption, and that is, we are the culture. So, you have someone like Carl Henry again, or Billy Graham. Clearly, they had confidence in the second half of the 20th century that we were winning. That's evident in terms of the language they used, the writings that they wrote. And only in the very last part of the 20th century did it seem to dawn on evangelicals that we are not winning, we're losing. And by that, we meant not anything eschatological, but rather the trajectory of the culture and its fundamental premises, its worldview. And as a matter of fact, evangelicals didn't start talking about worldview until they had to. And that was because of the dominance of rival worldviews. When evangelicalism thought itself in the driver's seat of American culture, you didn't have people worried about worldview thinking. You just thought. You have to think about worldview when you are in the midst of people whose fundamental presuppositions and ordering thoughts, their plausibility structures, as Peter Berger would say, are radically different. By the time you get to the end of the 20th century, evangelicals are in a very different situation. Mainline Protestantism has virtually collapsed. And by the way, one of the ways this becomes very evident was in the aftermath of the 2016 election. You may have seen articles, the Washington Post ran a great one, on the composition of the new Congress. And what's radically different, if you go back just a generation, is the fact that the largest identity of elected members of the United States Congress, especially the Senate, say 50 years ago, would have been Episcopalian and Presbyterian, with a few odd Methodists and the odd Baptists from the South mixed in. But primarily, you would have had mainline Protestant identity. All that's changed with the 2016 election. It didn't just change then. That change is reflected. If you just put, say, 1956 versus 2016, you have a radically changed picture. In the pressures of late modernity, in this pressure cooker, interesting questions about cooperation have emerged. Most controversially, in 1994, the statement known as Evangelicals and Catholics Together. First of all, if you had had a statement entitled Evangelicals and Roman Catholics Together and had suggested such a title in the 1960s or 70s, it would have been roundly rejected. First of all, before Vatican II, it would have been completely rejected by any Roman Catholic leader. But by the time you get to 1994, it is explicitly the pressures of late modernity that have brought about a rethinking of this. And of course, it became very controversial. You had Catholic leaders such as Richard John Neuhaus leading that side of the discussion. And you had evangelicals including Charles Colson and Bill Bright, Timothy George, my dear teacher, speaking in the next room as I speak, has described this as an ecumenism of the trenches. And of course, he later became kind of the successor to Newhouse as the leader of the Evangelicals and Catholics Together movement. The code word here that entered our vocabulary was co-belligerence. That is to say, we are fighting several fronts, and we're fighting together. Just to take one classic example, it was the Roman Catholic Church that was in the front lines of the pro-life movement long before evangelicals knew of such a need and felt the urgency of that need. Evangelical Christians were late to get to those front lines, and then a couple of interesting things happened. Evangelicals who got to those front lines not only discovered nuns and Catholics there before them, they discovered arguments upon which they became dependent. The Roman Catholic Church had centuries of argumentation in terms of public policy at the intersection of theological conviction, primarily through the secondary language of natural law. So in framing pro-life arguments that might be translated into public policy, evangelicals had to learn to shift from saying in the public policy context, because the Bible tells me so, to here's an argument for the intrinsic value of human life. Now, fast forward right now to yesterday's hearing in the Judiciary Committee of the United States Senate, where Judge Neil Gorsuch is at least partly being opposed because in his doctoral dissertation at Oxford University, written under John Finnis, the greatest and most influential living natural law theorist, he was then, by the way, at Oxford. He is now at Notre Dame University, which confirms all the suspicions of the opponents of Judge Gorsuch. But in his dissertation, written under Finnis, he argues for the intrinsic value of human life, meaning that that value is not something that later is achieved by a human being, but rather is intrinsic to the very gift of human life. So in other words, this argument is right there. Evangelicals had not thought through many of these issues. So in the pressures of late modernity, this co-belligerence became a coping mechanism in the face of modernity. And this meant that there was a mutual dependence of argument. There was a mutual strategy on many cultural issues. There was a mutual danger that was understood, especially right now, for instance, common patterns of argument and concern about religious liberty. And this is why so many evangelicals are concerned about a Supreme Court case about the Little Sisters of the Poor. Needless to say, if you go back 50 years, and evangelicals are profoundly uninterested in a case that would be in the name of the Little Sisters of the Poor. Now evangelicals understand there, but by the grace of God, go we, and not in some distant future, but right now. Also understood as a mutual temptation, and that is a temptation to minimize the gospel, to marginalize theology in the name of this co-belligerence. So let me just state, bluntly, I was expected to sign Evangelicals and Catholics Together in 1994. I had participated in some of those meetings. I expected to sign Evangelicals and Catholics Together because I recognized the need for what's rightly described as co-belligerence. Why did I not sign Evangelicals and Catholics Together at the cost of some friendships? It was because when the document was actually finalized, it went beyond co-belligerence to making theological assertions of commonality that I believed were untrue and injurious to the gospel. And that's why, and again, I'm speaking why I did not sign. That's why I had expected to. In other words, I think the co-belligerence, the common concerns, the common argument, we need not to deny that we are dependent upon one another in making arguments, and now that's a two-way dependence. We share the center of the target together in terms of many cultural issues, and especially issues like religious liberty. We share heartfelt urgencies on issues like the definition and integrity of marriage, the protection of the natural family, the advocacy for unborn human life. But this is where a whole new conversation amongst evangelicals had to emerge in terms of the limits of that kind of cooperation. And here's the other interesting thing to note. All this, again, on the Catholic side, so Protestants, historic Orthodox Protestants, used to count on Catholics being just as opposed to a false ecumenical assumption as we were. The change that came in Vatican II was so massive that the Roman Catholic Church redefined who we are in terms of the documents of Vatican II. We were no longer false Christians in false churches separated from Rome by rebellion and invincible ignorance. Instead, we became wrongly ordered churches in which basically you take Karl Rahner's notion of the anonymous Christian, we are anonymous Catholics. We will one day be Catholics, according to Vatican II, and we will come under the full authority of the Church and the dispensation yet to come, and we will no doubt spend some time in purgatory because of our obstinate, if ignorant, rebellion. But nonetheless, that was a fundamental disposition. Now, the reason that's important is because the Catholic Church now has a theological mandate to try to create common ground on these issues and looks to evangelicals differently. We look to Roman Catholics differently in terms of the fact that there is a true co-belligerence here. And we shouldn't be embarrassed to show up on the front lines of the pro-life movement and be standing beside a nun. But we can't forget sola fide. We cannot compromise the gospel. So, with time running out, is somebody going to say, I think the issue here is that we can be involved in common moral concerns, we can acknowledge common arguments, but we should not call what we're doing a ministry, but rather it is instead the defense of life or the defense of marriage. The moment we begin to institutionalize that into a ministry, then immediately theological issues get sublimated, not only by the institutional mandate, but by the kind of etiquette that then follows. The seventh development was increased concern and opportunity for social and cultural impact. So this is not just the pressures of late modernity. It is the awakening that took place, again, earlier than you might think. You have someone like Francis Schaeffer in the 1960s and 70s openly advocating for Christians to be far more involved in fighting poverty and injustice and being involved in the front lines, not only defensively against many of the evils of late modernity, but offensively, so to speak, in terms of being advocates for what we would now rightly call human flourishing. By the way, where do we get that language? We get that language in Catholic natural law. Everyone at TGC uses this language. We ought to at least footnote it and say, we're not going to be intellectually dishonest and believe that Carl Henry came up with that, or Billy Graham. But nor are we going to be embarrassed by saying we need some common arguments. We find ourselves making some common arguments because, especially when it comes to the defense of life, the defense of marriage, and the definition of justice and human flourishing, we share many moral concerns. And, of course, we also recognize that we can stand together on many theological affirmations, including the Trinity and the Christological declarations of the Church. But we also understand that part of what it means to come together as the Gospel Coalition 500 years after sola fide, and I know that's something of an anachronism, let's just say it's convenient and not wrong for us to date it 500 years from October 31, 1517. Kind of understand that isn't something that's just a part of evangelicalism. We believe it's the heart of the gospel. So, the eighth thing, finally, is the decline of denominations and institutions. So there's been the virtual collapse of the ability, in most places, to comfortably find cooperation in denominational or institutional terms. You didn't need Together for the Gospel in the 1950s. You didn't need the Gospel Coalition in the 1950s because you had the great denominational infrastructures and all the ministries went with them. We're in a very different situation now. And so our cooperation is being defined somewhat differently. And I would just offer to you, not only as a Baptist, not only as a Southern Baptist, but as a Protestant, that there's great danger in that. I say that as one of the founders of Together for the Gospel and a proud member of the Council of the Gospel Coalition. That is to say that the loss of the confessional fullness of our denominations and the loss of support for institutions that make the propagation of the faith and especially the training of ministers and a platform for global missions possible, that will come at a great cost. And it's one we ought to take very seriously, which is to say, the Gospel Coalition and Together for the Gospel, just to take two examples, are wonderful places to come together for common affirmation, common concerns. But when it comes to doing the work of the church, we're right back in the churches. And when it comes to missions, we're right back into something like a denomination. And it's because institutions require that kind of intentionality and structure. Okay, very quickly. Years ago, I wrote about theological triage, the necessity of doing triage on theology, on doctrines, to know what are first order, second order, and third order issues. It's not something completely new in the history of the Christian church. The early church had to determine what were the first order doctrines. They might not have used that language, but that was what they're deciding. What is required creedally in order for one to be a Christian? And then there are second order issues. They're important. By the time you get to the Reformation, this is what separates the reformers. Not first order issues. They stood together on sola fide, sola gratia. All five of what we now call the solas of the Reformation, the magisterial reformers were all agreed upon those. Where they differed was in some matters of ecclesiology, on the sacraments, and in terms of the Lutherans versus the Reformed, of course, matters of law and gospel. That's a big issue. But they didn't preach the gospel in a way that was so different that it was not recognized as the true gospel. And, of course, there was the intentional effort to ground the Protestant Reformation in the faith once for all delivered to the saints. In other words, the Reformers did not believe that they were leaving a church to establish another church. They come to the conclusion, as had Machen, that they were leaving a church that wasn't a church in order to recover the Church of Christ. Those second-order issues are important, and of course you get third-order issues. Third-order issues are not first-order issues. The first-order issues are issues constitutive of the gospel. That is to say, if someone denies this doctrine, he is or she is not to be recognized as a Christian. So it reminds me, I was in class one day. Louis Drummond was a professor, and he had Q&A time at the end of every lecture, which is actually the best part of the class. And I can still remember a student raising his hand and saying, "What do you call a person who doesn't believe in the bodily resurrection of Christ?" Dr. Drummond said, "A non-Christian, an unbeliever." An easy, correct answer. Ask Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Romans chapter 10. And so that's clear. They're first-order doctrines. And I would suggest to you that essential to the Reformation is the understanding that those first-order doctrines include the solas of the Reformation, that the gospel cannot coherently be articulated or coherently be defended without all of those solas. Now, let's fast forward. What does that mean? That meant that the Protestant churches did not anathematize one another, but they had separate churches. It comes down to second-order issues such as baptism and church order. And you fast forward to the last half of the 20th century, this includes the ordination of women in many denominations. Again, this comes out as a second-order issue. You're either going to baptize a baby or not, or call it, I'll say as a Baptist, capital B, call it baptism. In other words, you're going to decide this one way or the other, and you're going to establish your church according to these lines. You're going to define its ministry according to these lines. And by the time you look at this, there's a difference between saying this is not a true church and saying this is a church with which we are in disagreement. This is a denomination that we believe isn't as biblically ordered as it ought to be. We have a continuing disagreement. Some of my closest friends in the world, I'm proud to say, are Presbyterians. And that means we may be the last people on earth as a conservative Baptist and a conservative evangelical Presbyterian. We're the last people on earth who can have a decent theological debate. Theological liberals don't care enough to have this kind of debate. We actually believe it's important. But that both shows our commonality and, at least in this dispensation, that is to say in this life, until the Lord shall come and gather his church, we see no longer through a glass darkly, but see him face to face. We're going to be in disagreement on these issues. But we don't anathematize one another. We preach the gospel together. That's the point of Together for the Gospel, the Gospel Coalition. We stand in the gospel together. Third order issues aren't even of second-order importance. And, the easiest one, just for the sake of time, would be a pre-tribulation rapture. Those who hold to it tenaciously. But hopefully they don't anathematize, that is to say, they are unbelievers, those who disagree with them, And in most churches, you can have people who believe in a pre-tribulation rapture and those who do not, who can be in the same fellowship. Certainly, it's not a matter of ultimate fellowship. So the way I put it this way, first order agreement is necessary for evangelism. Second order agreement is necessary for congregationalism or denominationalism. And third order issues, agreement is necessary to be my friend. Just say I'm right on everything and we'll be friends. No, not to make light of it. Third order agreement is necessary to catechize in terms of any comprehensive catechism. And it's necessary in many cases for institutionalizing. In other words, if you're going to be adequately confessional, then you will admittedly, but it needs to be admitted. We need to say this is not a first order issue. It's not a second order issue. It's just an issue of our identity. We're not anathematizing those who disagree with us, but we're hiring those who do. That's fair enough. All right. Time is running out, but I need to get to something because this is of such importance as we think of this. The new thing we're all having to think about is the sexual revolution and all that it has wrought. So I want you to hear me to say that I believe these sexuality issues rise to first order importance. They don't always arrive at first order importance. That is to say, you can talk with people you know to be genuine believers who disagree on these issues, but they eventually end in first order importance because the church will teach and the church will affirm either what is in keeping with Scripture and the gospel or not in keeping. And in this case, is it injurious to the gospel? You're declaring what the Bible says to be sin to be not sin. Now, I think if I were just an American evangelical, a Southern Baptist talking about this, you would need to think very carefully about whether or not my own context is just too limiting, perhaps too congregational, perhaps too evangelical, to take it in terms of my argument. Thankfully, we have others who were brave enough to say some of the things they needed to say as this revolution was unfolding. So I want to cite someone who is Protestant, well, he's now no longer living. He was a Protestant, major Protestant, perhaps the most influential Protestant theologian in Europe in the second half of the 20th century. After Barth, it would have been Wolfhart Pannenberg. And Pannenberg was not an evangelical. But in the midst of the LGBT revolution unfolding, in an argument in his own church there in Germany, he made this argument. 1996. Those who urge the church to change the norm of its teaching on this matter must know that they are promoting schism. If a church were to let itself be pushed to the point where it ceased to treat homosexual activity as a departure from the biblical norm and recognized homosexual unions as a personal partnership of love equivalent to marriage, such a church would stand no longer on biblical ground but against the unequivocal witness of Scripture. The next line is really important. This is a line that should ring in our ears 500 years after Wittenberg in a very, very heavy way. Pannenberg concluded, quote, "A church that took this step would cease to be the one holy Catholic and apostolic church," period. That's the issue. In terms of first order issues, we have to be absolutely clear and unequivocal. We stand with the one holy Catholic, little c, an apostolic church. And that means we can't cooperate in any sense in terms of anything related to the gospel or the church or ministry with those who deny it. That raises an interesting question. So what about the front lines of that pro-life movement where we're dependent upon one another, we're dependent on mutual argument, we're driven by mutual concern? I think the Baptist Faith and Message in my own denomination says this about as well as it can be said, if you'll forgive me. The Baptist Faith and Message says that we can cooperate with all men, it was a dated statement, all men and women of goodwill in acts of social benevolence. And that is to say, if the house next door is on fire, you can hand a bucket to a Jehovah's Witness who hands it to a Mormon, and you're not compromising theologically. You can be involved in feeding the poor, housing the homeless, giving clothes to the naked, with people who are not gospel Christians, What you can't do is make it into a ministry. And what we can't do is ever cooperate at any level in such a way that we pull back our theological conviction in order to meet some other end. If the house on fire, if the house next door is on fire, put out the fire. But never compromise the gospel. If this were easy, we wouldn't have had this conversation. And if this were easy, you wouldn't have an evangelical movement. It's not easy. It's more important than easy. It's necessary. And it takes us regularly seeking the wisdom of God in Scripture, talking to one another. This is what makes something like the Gospel Coalition so important. We are here with the gospel not in question, but our faithfulness in question. Our hope and prayer is that by coming together with like-minded gospel Christians, we will think, pray, teach, preach, and live more faithfully. Thank you so much for coming. God bless you.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org.